just restate for me your name and your position in the project?
Well, my name is Patrick Holland, and I'm a trustee and also a brakeman on the Cuyahoga Valley Scenic Railroad.
And what is your date of birth?
I was born on January 25th, 1943.
Okay, were you born here in Cleveland?
In Chicago, Illinois.
And then when did you move to Cleveland?
I moved to Cleveland in 1960 to attend and finally graduate from John Carroll University.
And so your role in the project is a brakeman?
Well, it's I think probably really more as a trustee. I've been a member of the Board of Trustees of the Scenic Railroad since probably about 1978. The railroad has gone through a lot of changes since, but initially I was just, my role was kind of limited both as a trustee and I suppose was the liaison with the Midwest Railway Historical Society, which we can talk about. But when we got our own equipment and began to operate an expansive amount of equipment and operate on a regular schedule, then they needed more and more volunteers to fill in. And because I had had prior railroad experience as a college job, I took the FRA test that we administer to all of our operating personnel. And so now I kind of fill in when they need help running trains.
What are some of the runs? I know that they have, like, the Polar Express, what are some of the runs that you
Well, during the course of the year, we have what used to be called the Scenic but Explorer, and I think now it's more the Bike Aboard program, and we basically operate a train from Old Rockside Road, which is our most northern terminus, down to Akron, with all the stops in between. For people who either just want to ride the train, they can bring their bike on board for a greatly reduced cost, and then go as far as they want and bicycle back, or vice versa, bicycle down and take the train back. Or you can change trains in Akron and then take a second train down to Canton and do that. And there are a number of things to do both in Akron and Canton during kind of a layover period. So not as much to do, or at least we don't have connections in the north end. It's our long-term hope to be able to provide and gain train access or track access into downtown Cleveland so that we can basically physically connect all three cities. So someone from Akron or Canton could come up and spend the day at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or, you know, grab the rapid transit and come out to University Circle and go through the Art Museum. Or, I mean, it's just an incredible number of things or trips that you could put together. It could be a lot of fun.
So what initially got you started with this project?
Well, the I had a good friend, Roderick Boyd Porter, who at that time was the Cuyahoga County archivist, and I was also employed by Cuyahoga County. And he was, because of his position with the county archives, was related to and had a lot of working relationships with the Western Reserve Historical Society. The Western Reserve Historical Society was the actual incorporator of the Cuyahoga Valley Scenic Railroad. At the time, a gentleman by the name of Siegfried Buehrling, who was the director of Hale Farm and Village, and I think over a recreational beverage that he was sharing with Nick Maletti, who was the developer of the Richfield Coliseum back when the Cleveland Cavaliers played out there. They started talking about, you know, how can we get people out to Richfield without having to drive? And out of that concept came the Scenic Railroad. So Rod was a trustee, and the trustees at the time, again, we did not have any operating equipment, or the Scenic Railroad didn't have any operating equipment. They were primarily a marketing and ticket sales organization. But we were very dependent on the Midwest Railway Historical Society. And so there was sometimes some working friction between the members of the Midwest and the members of our board. And our board was a jolly lot that liked to party pretty hard. So, and so when Rod found out that I had actually had rail experience with the River Terminal Railroad, he drafted me in, and I was elected to the Board of Trustees, again specifically to be the liaison between the Midwest Railway folks. So, big part of my duties, if you will. I spent a lot of time down at the West 3rd Street Roundhouse helping them maintain the equipment, which was actually a lot of fun because the 4070, which was a Baldwin steam engine that was built in about 1917, was still operational, but it required lots of loving, tender care. Running those steam engines was truly very difficult because they'd only run on the weekend. Initially, we only ran on Saturdays. And steam engines are designed to be fired up and then kept hot, the fire going, for 7-8 years at a time. And what will destroy the metallurgy of a boiler is that constant heating and cooling, which is exactly what the Midwest was doing. And so it wore the engine out a lot faster, at least the steam part of it. And when the corrosion occurs and you get leaks, you lose pressure. So there were many occasions where they couldn't get up the hill into Akron. A lot of people don't understand that Akron is actually a lot higher than Cleveland. And so they had to call for a rental engine to basically give them a push. And railroads generally run on schedules, and people would board the train to go to Akron and then come back, and thinking that they would be back at 5 o'clock at night or whatever the schedule was. And, you know, if they had dinner plans on Saturday night, they weren't wild about being out on the railroad at 8, 9 o'clock at night. So, again, it was, you know, there were some real challenges in operating. The other really neat thing I got to do was one of the drive wheels of the steam engine got out of true. It developed a flat spot. And so the folks from the Midwest borrowed a piece of equipment from the Norfolk and Southern Railroad and was shipped up. And it was a portable lathe, which they attached to the wheel as it was still attached to the steam engine. They dropped one of the drivers off. And the thing went around like the second hand of your watch, very, very slowly, and basically shaved the wheel, steel wheel, back into a true round. And that probably had not been done in Cleveland for maybe 60, 70 years. So that was kind of neat. But so that, again, most of my experience or duties were basically working alongside the Midwest Railway folks.
So, and you've been active in getting it started and getting it up and getting it going. So what are some of the hurdles that you've encountered along the way?
Well, I think the largest one was, and I've forgotten the years, but I think it was in the early 80s, somewhere in that time frame, when the National Park Service acquired the right-of-way from CSX Corporation. The rail line had been originally a Baltimore and Ohio, a B&O line, and CSX took over the B&O. And the Park Service somehow managed to get an agreement from CSX to sell it. The process when you buy any kind of piece of land, you do a title search. And so they ended up doing a title search on a piece of property that was about 26 miles long and about 90 feet wide, through two counties. And when they got into Summit County, they discovered that all of the land records at the recorder's office at the county courthouse in Akron were not there. They had all been moved to Stark County because there had been a fire at some point in time in the Summit County courthouse, and the records were relocated while they were doing the renovations. They never moved them back. So that process took at least 2 years to just do the purchase process. And during those 2 years, there was really no traffic at all on the rail line. So by the time the Park Service actually acquired it and we got back into business, there were trees growing up between the two sets of rails. So there was a lot of work that had to been done on the rail line itself. I think that was one of the bigger challenges. The other challenge is certainly, it's an ongoing challenge, is to find money to continue to operate the railroad. Currently, about 55% of our revenue comes out of the fare box, so the balance of it, we basically have to go out and beg and do fundraising and development work of varying kinds. Because the operation today has about a $2.6 million annual budget. It is a major operation. Over the years, we've acquired a lot of operating equipment. I think we own about 13 engines now, diesel locomotives. And I've lost track of the number of passenger cars and boxcars and all of the other paraphernalia it takes to offer service and operate a railroad. So I think acquiring the right-of-way, some of the other challenges prior to the construction of the Fitzwater maintenance facility in Valley View, all the maintenance on the equipment was done in Peninsula out in the open on a siding track right alongside the Peninsula Lumber Company. If it weren't really for the support of the late John Lahosky, who was the manager of the lumber company, I don't think we would have survived. But it was not pleasant to be doing anything in the middle of the winter outside working on rolling stock of varying kinds. So the National Park Service acquired the Fitzwater Yard, as we call it today, but it was actually one of the Cuyahoga County engineers' yards that they really didn't need. And so the Park Service bought the property for $1 from the Cuyahoga County commissioners and then proceeded to build about a $4.5 million state-of-the-art maintenance facility that is heated. It's got a roof, all the nice things. So
it's part of the national park, am I correct?
Yes, we have a kind of a unique relationship with the national park because we are a concessionaire, using the Park Service terminology. They own the track, and the Park Service is responsible for the maintenance of the track and the bridges, and they provide the maintenance facility for us, and we operate over the track. Generally, though, a concessionaire would pay the Park Service for the ability to function within a national park. Actually, it's the other way around. Because of the economics of providing rail transportation, there's a reason that all the major railroads got out of the passenger business. It's a very expensive proposition. And if you'd have to pay for the whole... get all of your revenue out of the fare box, the trip from Cleveland to Akron would probably cost about $60, which is a little generally out of the price range of people who are taking a one-day excursion and aren't particularly, don't want to part with that kind of money. So what we bring, I guess, the other major facet that we provide for the national park, besides just operating a tourist railroad, is we last year carried about a little over 120,000 passengers. And those people came into the park and experienced the park, either on their bicycles or they got off at Hale Farm or did whatever they wanted to do, just ride, look at the eagles and all that stuff, without their automobiles. And in the Park Service operation, I don't know if you've ever been to Yellowstone, but in the height of the Yellowstone season in Wyoming, I mean, it looks like a superhighway. The roads are just jammed with vehicles, which kind of detracts from the whole concept of a natural park where you're experiencing the environment, because all you're looking at is the back of somebody's SUV or you know, big, huge motorhome. And they actually limit the number of vehicles that go into the park, which just kind of goes counter, especially the Cuyahoga Valley National Park is an urban park. I mean, in reality, it's a rural park, but it's an urban park because it's anchored on each side by a major city, which is a very unique factor. So, again, our ability to bring a substantial number of people into the park to experience the park without their automobile is a valuable thing to the Park Service, and so they're willing actually to dig down into their pocket and provide us with some operating support.
Well, that's nice. Does the park help financially with any financial problems with the train, or you said
the maintenance of the train itself is on us. I mean, we have a staff and that money either comes out of the fare box or we go out and raise the money. So whenever we buy a new piece of equipment or if an engine has to be overhauled, new parts and pieces installed, that's a cost that we have to assume. The Park Service, though, as I said, maintains the track and the right-of-way.
So that's the only thing. What's your favorite place or part of this project
Well, if you mean by project the experiencing the railroad, I guess I've got a couple. I generally work the Polar Express. We talked about the bike aboard programs, and we do a Thomas the Tank day out with Thomas the Tank, and we have wine trains and a lot of different theme trains. But we also do the Polar Express, and I get a lot of personal enjoyment of dealing or at least watching the kids and sometimes adults who have never ridden on a train before. So this is a big first time experience, and little children, you know, the literature of little children, kids' books are full of train stuff, and certainly Thomas the Tank is the leader of that pack. But to physically, you know, walk up the boarding path and come face to face with a big, huge steel passenger car or engine or what have you, and just to see the kids and the excitement that they have, and sometimes that includes grandparents too. I mean, it's the whole spectrum. So that's really, really neat. I mean, that keeps a lot of our volunteers coming back, just that one experience. The other memorable thing that is always in my mind's eye, when the Polar Express is headed to the North Pole, and as we're pulling into the North Pole, a.k.a. Peninsula, when you're going south, you cross the just before you get into Peninsula, you go through a cut. When they try to keep tracks as level as possible, and so there was, I'm sure, 100 plus years ago, they dug out a section to keep the grade at a reasonable amount, and so you're going through an area. You go over a bridge and over the Cuyahoga River into this cut, and you know it's dead of night. The light of the engine is, you know, the beam is aimed down that cut, and then you see the North Pole, and which is all lit up with Christmas lights and characters, and that's a pretty cool experience just to see that. that coupled with, I guess, the wildlife. Because as we were pulling in one day one evening, I remember seeing a coyote come down one side of that cut bank, cross the tracks, and shoot up the other side. So it was as you're going into the North Pole. So those are, I mean, you see lots of things. Passengers get to see things, but people who are working in the cab of the locomotive get an entirely different view of the railroad. And you're seeing it first, really. It gets scary sometimes too, because you're also seeing automobiles that are trying to dart across the tracks before the engine gets to it, and so sometimes you got your heart in your throat. But I think those are the things that immediately come to mind.
Why is this project important?
Well, I think it allows people, our citizens, the people who use the park, the ability, first and foremost, I guess, to experience rail transportation, which on a passenger basis is becoming harder and harder to do as Amtrak gets smaller and smaller. And you know, if you go back and look at the history of this country, the country really grew. The big first growth spurt was due to the ability to cross the country by rail. Took a long time to get from here to Oregon on a Conestoga wagon. The railroads made that trip a lot shorter. Obviously, they've been displaced by, you know, interstate highways and airplanes. But so it was an important part of our national history, certainly transportation history. I think the second thing it's really important is it does provide access into a national park to folks who might not otherwise have the ability to get there, because they might not own an automobile. There are a variety of things. That's really the reason we continue to try and work towards extending our operation into what we'll call downtown Cleveland. That could be Steel Yard Commons, or it could be the Terminal Tower. There are lots of institutional hurdles that have to be overcome, starting with the reluctance of CSX Corporation to let us run up there on their track, or even sell the track to us, or to anybody. But if you can envision, you know, someone living in Glenville, or Central, or you know, any other part of the city of Cleveland, being able to get on a bus, maybe with their bicycle, put their bike on the front rack, go down to the Terminal Tower, or a bus route over to Steel Yard Commons, and be able to then get on the scenic railroad. And again, you know, you and your bike cost $2, so it's a very affordable trip. And then go down into the national park. And we do school trips, not as many as we used to, but we do school trips. And there's a huge portion of the children who have never been into the national park. I mean, it's this great asset, really very close by, if you had an automobile. But for those people who are public transit dependent, we think this is a great way to open up the park, and you know, we will continue to work towards that goal. Right now, again, we only go as far as what we call Old Rockside Road, but it's Rockside Road. It's just a lower level. So that's Independence. And the last 7 miles really is, I mean, you can walk to the other side of Rockside Road and see the tops of the Terminal Tower from there, but we can't get there yet. So that's I guess, the remaining challenge.
I was going to ask, what do you think the future holds for this project? And taking into consideration, along with just the growth of it, the price of gas and how expensive it is.
Well, that's hitting us, too, to be very candid with you. Diesel fuel, actually, and the engines we use are what they call ELCO, or American Locomotive Company, manufactured these engines. And they're what's called electric diesels. So it's a diesel engine that operates and creates electricity that then is used to turn the wheels. But you still need to buy diesel fuel, which is more expensive than gasoline. And so we're spending currently, and this will become very dated soon, I'm sure, but well over $18,000 a month on diesel fuel, which is really stretching the budget. So from that aspect, conversely, if you take that 100,000 people and put them into their automobile and ask them to drive someplace, I mean, there's the trade-off. I mean, we are actually a form of public transportation. And you know, as you probably read, RTA is going through the same thing, is they got more ridership, but the fuel's up, and so they're now talking about reducing service, which, you know, on the face of it doesn't make sense. But the economics drive the process. So I think that is clearly a challenge. We've just experienced this for a number of years now, is the CSX Corporation, the freight railroad people, I don't know, hate's kind of a wrong word, but just want nothing to do with any type of passenger service. 'Cause, and the rationale, and it's probably a valid rationale to some extent, is the liability issue of somebody getting hurt on a passenger train and then suing the company. We have a hard time with that argument. Well, CSX said, yeah, you could use our track, but we want you to maintain $500 million of insurance to cover us just in case, which if you go find out the premium cost of $500 million, our $60 ticket has now gone to about $250. I mean, it's humongous. That has become difficult, but we find it, you know, a strange argument because our railroad's top speed is 25 miles an hour, but as you get into an urban area like going north into downtown Cleveland, where the track conditions aren't particularly great, I think our top speed at that point would be about 10 miles an hour. So I'm not too sure of what kind of major catastrophe we could get into at 10 miles an hour. I think it would be probably more dangerous for someone that's on the ground next to the train than a passenger. But that's the argument they're using, and they own the track. And if you talk to elected officials anywhere, you'll find it's a universal refrain that dealing with the railroads makes dealing with the Pentagon simple. It's their way or no way, basically. Not even the highway, just the no way. So we continue to try to build public and political support for getting them to even sit down and talk to us. That's a huge, huge challenge. The railroad will continue to grow and offer different services. We're somewhat hampered in that we have a single track. So, you know, when you have more than one train on a single track, you have to do a little maneuvering, and there are operating procedures that you have to follow. Our trains never come within half a mile of one another. That's just true flat out. I was going to say the one exception is in Peninsula, where last year, we're not running the service anymore, but last year the southbound train, the northbound train from coming out of Akron would come to Peninsula, and then the southbound train would come in and take the siding, and then passengers would switch trains between the two. But we've not for safety reasons, but we've discontinued that service, and now we just want to run one train the whole length of the Cleveland Akron right away, and generally I think we're doing that trip now four times a day.
are some surprises come along during this project?
Hmm.
Or what has surprised you?
Surprises. I don't know if I've been surprised. I mean, I may be pleasantly surprised. I've met a lot of nice people. We have a huge number of volunteers, and there was well over 30,000 hours last year, 36,000 hours of volunteer time last year. And when you do the math, and if that basically replaces about 21 full-time employees. I mean, it's just, it's huge. And those people come from all walks of life. I mean, there are a few former railroaders, but I've met doctors, lawyers. There's a retired airline pilot that's a brakeman and is in the class to become an engineer. You name it. I mean, it just... Trains draw people, I suppose, from childhood interest on, and it's always fun to meet, you know, folks who enjoy volunteering on the railroad. I think that's probably been the most pleasant surprise. I can't think of surprises in terms of negative surprises, other than the possible stupidity of people who try to drive in front of a moving train. That is always mind-boggling. you'd think they'd know better, but nope.
You mentioned volunteers. How many employees are there?
I think we have about 24 full-time employees, and then we have a handful of part-time employees who, for the most part, are engineers, railroad engineers, who actually work on other railroads, and they can't seem to get enough. I don't know, but they enjoy the passenger service and the location and that sort of thing. So I don't know exactly how many. I think probably about three or four of those guys, So I think about 24.
You're a trustee, and who else is involved in this project?
Well, we have a board that I think is, if it's fully staffed, there's 21 people. We have a number of different types of committees that's formed, as most boards are. And they generally follow the old saw about the three W's, wealth, wisdom, or work. So they're all hopefully contributing one or more of those W's to the process. We have an office staff. We have a president and CEO, and then there are a group of directors that are kind of functional line item, operations, development, finance, reservations. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. Marketing. And then, you know, folks below them. In the operations part of it, there's at Fitzwater Road, which is where the operations director is located. We just had an opening, if you're interested in applying. So, because the former director of operations is taking a job over in Western New York on a short line railroad. But we have a maintenance, full-time maintenance crew, and then a dispatcher who is actually the key person in the whole operation, because you don't move any piece of equipment an inch without the dispatcher issuing written train orders. This railroad is run, you know, exactly the same as any large railroad anywhere in the United States. We have a train master and an assistant train master, and then engineers, brakemen, consist of the train crew. The conductors, I think there are three or so full-time paid staff folks who function as conductors. And when the railroad is, when the train is out on the track, it's not the engineer in charge, it's the conductor. He tells everybody. He's the commander-in-chief. And then we have the trainmen, who are the car attendants, if you will. Those folks are almost always volunteers. But they're volunteers who go out and spend their own money, and we have a standard uniform that the black suit with the flat top hat and that whole thing. All of these folks could go through training courses, from trainmen up. Obviously, when you're operating equipment, it's a little different than dealing with the public. So it's really a very highly organized operation. I think railroads were probably one of the first bureaucracies in the United States, and for good reason, because rail equipment can really hurt you. That's those big steel wheels are very unforgiving.
You mentioned that you were working on a few projects. Has this train project spurred other projects for you? Or what are some of your other projects?
Actually, it's I guess just because of my general rail experience. My day job, I'm the executive director of the Cuyahoga County Solid Waste District. And for a variety of reasons, fuel being one of the major ones, the transportation of waste out of the county for disposal is a huge task. And Cuyahoga County exports 99.9% of its waste out of the county for disposal. When I first started, there were, I think, 14 operating landfills in the county. There's only one public operating landfill, and it's a very tiny facility. So we transport about 1.8 million tons of solid waste up until very recently, all by truck. But as diesel fuel goes up and those costs continue to escalate, we are taking a very, very serious look at instituting a rail haul scenario. And as you've probably heard on public radio, CSX does a series of, not commercials, they're simply announcements, but their tagline is they can move 1 ton of material 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. So the mode of the economics, I guess, of rail, after you get through the infrastructure capital costs, the operating costs are very favorable. And so, you know, because of, I guess, my overall rail experience and knowing what goes into it and learning a lot more about rail operations throughout the state of Ohio, and especially some of the short line railroads, there's more than likely a rail haul scenario in Cuyahoga County's future. So we will not be using the track that goes down through the park. But
So what is next for this project? Where do you see this project?
Oh, I think you know, the railroad will continue to grow. We have just acquired. We're going to continue, I guess, to get more user friendly equipment for the passengers. We've just acquired, and that just is within the last year. Railroad moves sometimes very slowly. A dome car, and it's a historically significant dome car. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad had two dome cars manufactured for them, but then never used them. But they were designed a little bit differently than the dome cars you see in pictures of the Santa Fe Railroad that runs, you know, through the desert and out in the west. 'Cause these domes were not in the center of the car; they were more to one end of the car, and the domes themselves were lower. They didn't go quite as high, primarily because the B&O at that point, their primary service was between Ohio and Washington, New York, and you go through a lot of tunnels, and so you've got a height limitation for cars. The car we purchased was down in Georgia in significant disrepair. Have no idea how it got there or what that part of the history is, but the car is currently in East St. Louis being refitted. They've put all new glass and framework in on the dome part, and they're doing the other basic work they'll have to do in order to have the car transported up to us, and then we have the ability to do most of the interior work. That's going to be kind of neat, is to reintroduce an historical B&O car back onto B&O track, or what was former B&O track. And you know, I mean, the value of that, obviously, it's going to become a premium seating car, because you know as you roll through the park, and basically the marsh wetland area south of Valley View, but north of Brecksville, in that area, is where the blue herons roost up in the trees. If you've ever taken the railroad, may have seen it. And then the eagles have now moved in, and they're borrowing some of the blue heron nests, I'm sure much to the displeasure of the blue heron. But and there are times of the year when the eggs have been laid and the eagles are tending the eggs that the park service has really just literally stopped pedestrian traffic through that area to leave, so people leave the eagles alone. But we still can roll through the area. We limit the use of the bells and horns, the signaling devices we're required to use. And the eagles have seemed to have gotten used to us. I guess, you know, we've become part of their environment. That's pretty cool to see. And again, we're being up front, you know, we're seeing them first. But they generally don't fly away. We just roll through the area. Being able to see that from a dome car will be, I think, really special. And certainly, you know, pulling into the North Pole. And I think some of the other service that we've been talking about and have actually done a pilot run is providing what in the industry is called a dinner train. Where you could board the train at one end or the other and take an evening ride down and enjoy a meal, a gourmet meal. Similar to the old days when I first started coming to Cleveland and to attend John Carroll University, we took the train really probably through my junior year. There were stretches of the either Indiana or Ohio Turnpike that weren't even built yet. So the train was a relatively inexpensive way to get over here. And they had club cars, so you could, you know, kind of drink your way across, which was, for college kids, you know, a prerequisite. And so we enjoyed that service, but if you've ever ridden anywhere on any train, and I guess the nicest experience I had was we took a train from London to Aberdeen, Scotland, on Brit Rail, and then when you get to the Scottish border, it magically becomes ScotRail. But it was a daytime train, so we had lunch on board the train with the white starched white linen tablecloth and the, you know, the heavy silverware and, you know, nice food, very nice food, and a cocktail, and you know, it's just a very pleasant way to travel, and we think that there's probably a demand for that kind of experience, not on a daily basis, but kind of on a maybe similar to the scheduling we do for the wine tasting trains. which are, again, are very popular. Food and beverage always brings people. So so I think, you know, those are, I think, kind of two more near-term projects. We have acquired enough rolling stock. We've bought some what we refer to as cafe cars from Amtrak, actually. And I should hasten to add that all of our equipment is kind of 50s vintage. So it's all, you know, pretty close to 60 years old, most of it. We decided early on that just the cost of maintaining steam equipment and the period coaches that would match steam equipment was just way too expensive. And there actually becomes, I think, something of an environmental issue, too, because steam engines burn coal, and, you know, that's... we've occasionally run steam through the valley, and I think the occasional amount of soot and air pollution we're producing, we can get away with. But if it was on a regular scheduled basis, I think there are people living close to the railroad tracks who would have a really hard time with that. But we're you know, that type of service, I think, is got a future. But we have the ability, I guess the other kind of neat car is it's entitled the St. Lucie Sound, but it's a business class car. It's got the rounded nose at the end. And we acquired that car probably 10 years ago now, or maybe a little longer, from a Canadian businessman who had purchased the car. It came off the Eastern, I've forgotten the name of the railroad, the Eastern Seaboard Railroad. And actually, there's a strong Cleveland connection. The Fiegler line, it was called. Fiegler. Mr. Fiegler, and I've forgotten his first name, was one of the original
Pardon? The news guy?
No, well, he was a railroad magnate, but he got his money because he was a partner of John D. Rockefeller. So when Standard Oil began really here in Cleveland, Fiegler was an officer in the company, and I don't know, secretary of trade. Charlie Pratt was the treasurer. Maybe he was the secretary, but he was an officer in the company. Made a lot of money. And moved to New York and had the bright idea of building a railroad down the eastern seaboard of the United States to Miami, and actually built a railroad right away along to the Florida Keys to Key West, and then transported the railroad cars across the Gulf to Cuba. And the concept, And this was to make money, to make note of it, you know, make it very clear, to be able to provide a transportation method to bring fresh produce, bananas, you know, whatever they were growing, and sugar, certainly, in Cuba, up on that railroad line. And the construction down through the Keys was actually one of those engineering marvels, you know, that kind of rival the Panama Canal, and they got it operational. And then there was a hurricane, however, and I think it was about 1934, that just took out big, huge sections of the rail right away down that connected all the Keys. And they never, in 34 being in the height of the Depression, they never rebuilt them. But if you drive in an automobile down US 1, and you can see the pilings, and I mean, all that stuff is still there. Fiegler was also the guy who developed and really caused the real estate boom in Palm Beach. So the Breakers, and his home was in Palm Beach, and his home currently is a museum, which is well worth the couple of bucks it cost to go through. But parked out in back in the backyard was Fiegler's personal rail car. But he, this car, well, the St. Lucie Sound came off of the Fiegler Railroad. St. Lucie is a town just north of Palm Beach. And a Canadian businessman acquired the car, had it restored, but in an Art Deco style. And it's a gorgeous car. And it's got three or four staterooms, including a shower. It's off the main hall, which is a copper-lined room, a full kitchen, a little bar area, and a kind of a lounge area, and then the observation end of the car, the rounded end, has kind of, you know, tub chair seating for, I don't know, about 20 people. But built into the wall is a kind of an accordion table that will stretch about half the length of the observation area. So they used to... He wrote the car off as a business expense. That's where they'd have their board meetings, and again, he was a plastic manufacturer, and somewhere along the line, he sold his company to a group of German investors, and the car was in the corporate name, and when the folks from Germany arrived and realized they owned a railroad car that they had no use for, it got put up on the auction block, and we acquired it. At a very reasonable price, and so that was kind of the crown jewel of the rolling stock, and then that car coupled with the cafe cars provides, you know, an interesting train set, and we think with the dome car on top of that will provide for a very interesting kind of luxury rail experience. Because the cafe cars have tables and chairs where you can sit down and literally have dinner. We also have, and I think I should mention, a handicap car, the Invacare, how could I forget, that's got wheelchair access elevators that come off the side. So... We are a handicap access. I don't know if that's not still politically correct terminology, but so we have the ability to, for folks who are wheelchair bound, to bring them on board the train. The car is specifically designed. It's got removable seats, so they can travel, you know, with folks who are ambulatory, but we can lock down the wheelchair if they can't get out of the chair. So they're not rolling around inside the car as we're moving. So it's a railroad, I think, that as you travel across the United States, there are a number of scenic railroads. But this is one it's got a tremendous amount of equipment. It's a unique venue in which to travel, connecting major cities. That's a cool thing. And we will continue to grow it and fine-tune it. And if we can get into Cleveland, we will certainly do that.
You have amazing passion for the railroad, and it's really enjoyable to listen to.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And I think we're, you know, again, the being able to introduce people to a piece of history, you know, if you go look at our mission statement, it's, you know, riddled with, you know, historic preservation language, which we certainly have to do to keep this really 60-year-old equipment operating. But it introduces people to something that they've never experienced before, and that's cool.
Do you have any questions, ma'am?
Yes, I have a few. Just briefly, could you describe for us just maybe a significant feature of the landscape riding this railroad that really sticks out in your mind?
Well, I think there are 27 bridges that we cross, so you're continually crossing the Cuyahoga River. It snakes back and forth, and the river is a great thing to look at because you're kind of up high looking down into the river, so you'll see, you know, the herons fishing, people fishing, but the herons are certainly fishing. And occasionally you see an eagle swoop down, you know, I've seen that before. The river also, though, is probably our greatest enemy. I've learned a lot, I guess, about water management. And as we have, if people have built, have literally paved over northern Ohio, the runoff and the damage that flooding can cause is we're seeing today in the newspaper and out west and in the Midwest. We had an experience 3 years ago now of major flooding in the southern end where we lost, you know, significant portion of right-of-way. I mean, I've got pictures, the Park Service has pictures, of railroad track and ties suspended in midair, and everything that was underneath it was gone. So they're just hanging there, you know, in suspended animation. So the river can do a lot of damage, and I think it's certainly brought into focus for me personally, and I think a lot of people, that the management of growth is something that we really ought to be thinking about. And I know it's a constant struggle for the National Park Service to maintain that buffer zone between the green part of the park and people who want to build condo developments, you know, literally in the park. So there's always competing land use issues. But as it relates to the railroad, when you get one of those gully washers, it can be, you know, it can do a lot of damage. And it's not cheap to replace, you know. The National Park Service, again, as I said, they are responsible for the maintenance of the right-of-way and the bridges. And fortunately, the deputy director, John Debo's number two guy, had come from one of the western parks and knew of a very little used provision in the federal budget process where the bulk of transportation money goes for the maintenance of highways. I mean, concrete is king, both at the federal and state level. But there is a little-known provision that provides for emergency funding to put roads back into service following a natural disaster, which this flood clearly was. And so they were able to access those funds and come up with about $2 million and get us back into operation within 2 or 3 months, which was remarkable. Because we figured, you know, it'll be 2 years before that ever happens. And so they were able to do that. So I think the rivers clearly, coupled with the wildlife you see, the park is lousy with deer, which has become really a problem for them. But we see coyotes, fox, all kinds of birds that are, you know, and other little critters that are racing across the rail tracks in front of us. So, again, the perspective you have from the cab of the engine is really a lot different than being in the passenger car. You still see a lot of that stuff in the passenger car, but that's kind of the fringe benefit of working the railroad.
I just have one more. You're talking about CSX and some of the issues that you've had to deal with trying to extend your railroad line into Cleveland, and you talked about building public and political support. What would be one of the strategies that you would use to do that?
We've put together groups of folks. I guess we call them advisory committees. Actually, in all the major cities, Akron, Canton, as well as Cleveland. And the people who have agreed to serve on those committees are, you know, to some extent, the shakers and movers of each of the major towns, from what is now the Cleveland Partnership, but basically the growth associations of those communities, local elected officials, both county and city, people who potentially, if they pick up the phone and call, someone would actually take the call. I think so having that kind of public support. is clearly crucial. We are just in the, I hope, initial stages of commissioning a, not really a market plan, but rather a an economic development impact statement, if you will. What does it mean to a community to bring tourist dollars, because that we are a tourist railroad and not a commuter railroad. What does it mean economically? What's the benefit? You know, besides being able to go look at eagles or something, and spend a nice afternoon. What there's a dollars and cents issue here, and we think that's important for decision makers, be they federal, state, local, for them to fully comprehend. So I gather we're talking to Team Neo about maybe doing some of that work. But it's developing that, you know, that public support, certainly, you know, media. The train is a very photogenic operation. They just recently, Channel 8, forgotten her name, but it's the morning show. Rode the train and
oh, Robin Svoboda.
There you go. And got off in Peninsula and talked to a lot of people in Peninsula, and you know, it's just looking at all that. And again, it was, you know, neat film, you know, a great picture to tell over television. Certainly, you know, our Thomas the Tank and Polar excursions are equally photogenic and neat and a little bit unusual. It's not something that every shopping mall has. They got a Santa Claus, but we got a Santa Claus too. But we got the real one because we go to the North Pole. And so we try to use the media as much as possible, not just for marketing, but just telling the story. And it's a neat story, so... but I think our advisory committees are very important aspects of that outreach process. Ultimately, though, to be very candid with you, it will be our federally elected representatives, because CSX is a large national company, and I think the only people there, they have any, I'm not going to use the word fear, I'll say respect for, is probably the federal government. And so our state, our senators and congressional representatives are, we think, going to be key to being able to get CSX to the table. And quite honestly, there are other aspects that really ought to be thought about. When you look at the Cuyahoga Valley and all of the other valley initiative, the towpath trail, the extension to Lake Erie, you know, we provide that kind of that parallel facet. We run along the towpath. So if you could board your bike and or board the train in Akron and ride to Lake Erie, if you got enough pedal power in you, and then be able to take the train back from downtown Cleveland, again, very unique thing. So we're kind of working in concert with the towpath trail folks and but the only way that's going to happen, quite honestly, is getting CSX to the table is through the federal representatives. I think the other group out there that may have a longer term role potentially is the Port Authority, because sooner or later. As you've probably seen, they've announced plans potentially to move the port to the 55th, East 55th in the Shoreway area, away from the mouth of the river. But they are also at the same time talking about expanding the type of transportation the port is receiving. It's a bulk handling port now, so it receives and ships steel, stone, or, you know, basic materials. But there is a renewed effort, and actually I've been talking to them about this, is expanding the role of container traffic, those big 20 or 40-yard steel boxes that all of the goods in the Orient and anywhere in the world are shipped in on these big, huge 10,000-box boats that go across the Pacific and the Atlantic in the Indian Ocean. The difficulty is currently is everything coming from the Asian side hits the ports along California mostly. Port of Los Angeles is probably the biggest, and there's a bottleneck there, because what happens is they unload those boats. They have a huge laydown area where the footprint of the port in Los Angeles is actually very small. So they unload things, put them on rail cars, and they have a dedicated railroad that runs 12 miles inland, where they have this big sprawling yard where all of those things are put on the ground. And then it goes they're either reloaded onto rail cars for a trip across the United States for distribution purposes, or they're up until recently were being put on, a lot of them were putting on flatbed trucks to be driven across the country or wherever they're going. But there's a bottleneck there. I mean, there's just too many containers coming in for what they can handle. So there's a move underfoot to be able to reroute some of that traffic to go through the Indian Ocean, through the Suez Canal, which can handle a boats that size, through the Mediterranean and then through the Atlantic. Or the alternate route would be go down around the Cape and south of Africa and then come across that way. And basically end up in at the mouth of the Seaway in Halifax. The St. Lawrence Seaway, however, is not big enough to take a boat that size. So you would, in essence, have to take the boxes off and then put them onto either lake freighter-sized boats or possibly barges, and then distribute all of those goods through the Great Lakes, through Lake Erie and over into Michigan and Huron and Ontario. And when you look at where the number of consumers are in the United States, the Midwest is still a huge center area. So the closer you can get those things to the consumers from the logistical side, the better off you are. Water is the cheapest form of transportation known to man. So it makes a lot of sense. My particular interest in that was the backhaul process, because once you unload the box full of DVD players or whatever was in them, the empty has to go back. So from our perspective, we were looking at the potential of putting commodities or recycled materials, so fiber, metal, plastic, what have you, because the huge demand for those materials is in Asia. That's what's driving the recycling markets today. So we could backhaul at a very reasonable expense to get those materials back, where then they convert them into new DVD players and all the other stuff they sent us that goes into Walmart. So, but in order to do that, the port needs more space. And there's only so much lakefront in Cleveland. And so we've been talking to the port about looking inland for a laydown area for those containers and then connecting the two with rail. And we think there is a viable link using the CSX line that goes up into downtown Cleveland as part of that process. So we'll see how that turns out. I mean, we're in a very, very conceptual stage at this point, but we think the Port Authority in the long term will be a player in this.
Mike, do you have any questions?
Not really. I just wanted to know how someone would get started in the railroad, when I get stopped by a railroad crossing, I often wonder, how did you get that job?
Actually, the railroads are really looking for people. The railroad industry is full of old folks like me, and so they have schools. The railroads actually will put you through a training course, but there are schools, kind of freestanding schools, just like you'd. Not exactly a Tri-C operation, but where you go and learn the basics of being a brakeman or how to run a locomotive or what have you. That's actually one of the things we have thought about internally is maybe kind of a profit center to help raise money is to run a school. We've had volunteers. Actually, last summer we had an intern, a young man who was attending that kind of a school in New Jersey. And so when he arrived, he was looking for, you know, practical experience for hours, you know, work hours, besides a paycheck. But and it was great. I mean, this young man, you know, from day one, knew everything he needed to know, and was a valuable asset. So, you know, we have a training class underway right now where we're teaching, I think there are four guys in it right now that are working to become a locomotive engineer. And, you know, there's a very distinct process you go through, a little bit of classroom, but it's mostly hands-on experience, you know, hours behind the throttle with a licensed engineer sitting alongside you. And once you get that ticket, you know, that's a very marketable piece of paper. I mean, guys can go to work anywhere on short lines or CSX, or they get snapped right up. So, and occasionally we've had people who show up as volunteers and have gone through our training course and our examination and have kind of moved on up into full-time railroading. It's an occupation that there's a lot of demand for it.
What kind of hours? Is that like a flight, like a pilot where you have a hub, or do you go from one side to the other?
The FRA, the Federal Rail Administration, is the kind of the controlling federal body, and so your work day is maxed out at 10 hours, and then it's very similar to the truck drivers where your work period, and then you have a mandatory, you're off the job, you know, rest period, if you will. And there are a lot of variations to that, but it's basically 10 hours. It's actually a limiting factor for us to some extent because people say, well, why don't you run one train all the way to Canton and back? Well, if we did that, there's a good chance we'd end up running over that 10-hour limit because it's not from the period where passengers board the train at Rockside Road. The train actually starts, you know, what we call the crew call, generally about an hour and a half before you start boarding passengers. So the train comes up from Fitzwater Road where it's kept, Fitzwater Maintenance Facility, to board the passengers, go through the whole day, and then you take the train back and you know, put it up for the night or shut it down or whatever, depending on the season. And that can get to be a real long day, at which point, you know, it's very easy to get into violation of the FRA rules. And they check. I mean, the FRA folks come out and visit us on a regular basis. And if there's an injury, you know, somebody stubs their toe or falls off something, or they're there. It's the rail version of OSHA, I guess. So it's a serious business, but you know, there are time limitations.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All your information.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it.
You're welcome. My pleasure. I always like to talk about the railroad.